Hello all, and welcome to this online event held at the International Inequalities Institute entitled The Unintended Consequences of Quantifying Quality: Does Ranking School Performance Shape the Geographical Concentration of Advantage? This forms part of our inequalities seminar series and will last until around 1:30. I'm Nora Weitkus, I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the III at the LSE, and I will be chairing this event. Today's speakers are Dr. Aaron Reeves and Dr. Daniel MacArthur. Aaron Reeves is an associate professor in the Department of Social Policy and Intervention at Oxford University and a visiting senior research fellow in the International Inequalities Institute. His research interests are in the political economy of health, the political and cultural consequences of mass media, and the cultural politics of class. Daniel MacArthur is a postdoctoral research fellow in the Department of Politics and International Relations, also at Oxford University. And he recently completed a PhD in sociology at the III at LSE, where he studied how economic advantage and income inequality shape the prevalence of stigmatizing attitudes towards people in poverty. Please note that today's event is a Zoom meeting rather than a webinar, which means we can see all our attendees. If you could keep your cameras on and your microphones muted where possible, this will ensure a smooth running event. Please be aware that this event will be recorded for video and podcast purposes. We will have time for Q&A towards the end of the event. Please either type your questions into the chat function, stating your name and your affiliation, or use the raise hand function in Zoom if you wish to ask a question to the panel directly, and you will be requested to unmute yourself if invited to speak. Before I hand over to our speakers, a note on upcoming events this term at the III. Tomorrow afternoon, there will be a public event called The Politics of Inequality, Why We Should Focus on Resistance from Below, which is part of the LSE's Shaping the Post-COVID World, Initiative. Next Tuesday, the III seminar series will continue with the event, The Economic Consequences of Major Tax Cuts on the Rich, at 12:30. Details to both events can be found in the chat function, as well as more information on further upcoming events and staying up to date with research that is done at the III. I will now hand over to our speakers. Thank you everyone for joining today, and please enjoy this event.
Thank you so much, Nora, and also really thank you to the III. I think both Dan and I, for various reasons, are really excited to be back and presenting today. And actually, this paper started when we were both working at the LSE, and so this is kind of a nice opportunity for us to kind of come back and speak about some of what we've been up to. So I'm going to start sharing my screen. So I think the first thing that I want to acknowledge is that this is research funded by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, and that program of work, when I was actually based at the III, was thinking about the relationship between inequality and poverty. And in those conversations, one of the issues that I became particularly interested in was how revealing inequality or making inequality manifest in a particular kind of way may affect poverty and actually the geographical concentration of poverty. And this paper is an attempt to think about that question through the lens of school league tables and residential segregation. So I won't need to tell anyone on this call why residential segregation is important. Where you grow up can have an important influence on the qualifications that you get, the type of job that you end up working in, how much you earn, and even how long you live. And these so-called neighborhood effects, that is, irrespective of our own class position, that where we live can have, to quote Massey and Denton, an effect on our social and economic well-being, is a crucial issue that we need to sort of unpack more carefully. And there are two large debates in this area. The first is really about the trends in residential segregation. In the US, the pattern is quite clear towards increasing residential segregation across a number of socio-demographic dimensions. In the UK, interestingly, the pattern is slightly less clear and depends on the degree, on the scale at which you're analyzing the data. But Dan and I are primarily interested in the second of these kind of debates, the drivers of residential segregation. And we can here go back to kind of classic work such as Schelling's, which argues that even small preferences for people who are perceived to be like themselves can over time lead to increasing polarization between groups. But more recent work has questioned the degree to which this type of account focused on subtle, largely often unobserved preferences may be insufficient to account for kind of high levels of segregation that we observe in some contexts. And we think this is particularly true on the dimensions that we care about in this paper, which is primarily concerned with occupational class and to some extent, implicitly at least, income. So what other accounts are available to us? Well, one that Bischoff and Reardon have offered for the US case specifically is concerned with income inequality. Here the story is intuitive. You know, people, the beneficiaries of rising income inequality in the US were better positioned to move to areas where they could congregate with others who were affluent and avoid those who perhaps who were, had less resources. But what Dan and I are going to do here is actually draw on an insight from Allard and Small. In reviewing this literature, including the work on income inequality, they've noted that institutions have been somewhat neglected in this space. And for us, institutions are important not only because they are kind of rules that govern social relations, but also because they can be both informal and formal. And we're particularly interested in this instance in a kind of formal rule around school league tables. I'll say more about that in a moment. And these formal rules can sometimes even lead to the creation of organizations which ensure that those rules are adhered to. And so what we think is potentially important is that even if income inequality is part of the story that explains patterns of residential segregation, income inequality's effect on residential segregation is perhaps linked to institutions too. And one manifestation of this is the role of education and education organizations. So in important work in the US by Anne Owens, in two papers, in fact, she's tried to unpack the role that education has in explaining the link between income inequality and residential segregation. And what she argues is that yes, income inequality does seem to be linked with residential segregation, but it only seems to be the case that income segregation has increased among families with children. And then in a follow-up paper, she shows how changes in the availability of different types of schools, particularly constraints around school choice, potentially actually have contributed to these patterns of residential segregation. So this really is sort of where our question comes in. We're interested in trying to unpack how institutions may structure neighborhood conditions through shaping patterns of residential segregation. And we want to try and make a contribution here to a larger theoretical project which tries to understand the causes and consequences of residential segregation more broadly. Our focus, as I've mentioned before, is school league tables. And what we're trying to understand is how school league tables may have affected these patterns of residential segregation. And we think school league tables are useful for at least two reasons. One is they are a kind of institutional rule governing how we think about school quality. But these school league tables were also intended to alter decision-making that parents were making, particularly around the schools that their children attended. And we think that these school league tables would actually maybe have altered how people think about their local schools and even their local communities in ways that could have informed and changed their decision making. So we want to use these kind of introduction of school league tables in the 1990s as a way of thinking about these changing patterns and how people made these decisions. And we make an assumption in examining this question. That is, we think people do care about access to good services, and that when people are moving, they care about access to these services enough that they factor explicitly into their decision-making their ability to access these types of services, including educational institutions. And there's good evidence to back up that kind of claim from a variety of sources. But when we think about what the production of school league tables is doing, for Dan and I, it's really about the quantification of school quality. That is, trying to render school quality as measurable, usually in some sort of quite linear way, which kind of basically says, here is a number which tells you how good this particular school is. And we don't necessarily make a judgment on whether that quantification process is correct or not, but we are interested in the effects that it has. And we think there could be two possible mechanisms through which this type of quantification potentially could affect patterns of residential segregation and mobility. The first is that it seems that different social groups responded to the information provided in school league tables in different ways. Some parents think about school league tables as being the dominant piece of information that they use in their decision making, while others situate it in a kind of more holistic environment, taking into account the preferences of the child, where they live relative to these other schools, etc. And early work by Ball and others has shown that there's a kind of class dimension to these responses to school league tables. So they interviewed and talked to parents who were responding to the publication of these league tables early on, and noted that there was a kind of working class discourse dominated by the practical and the immediate, and that this should be situated alongside a more middle class discourse that was dominated by the ideal and the advantageous. So there seems to be some evidence we suggest that people in different positions would have responded to the information provided in these school league tables in different kinds of ways. But alongside that, we acknowledge that people in different positions also face financial constraints in their ability to respond to the information provided in those league tables too. We know, and there's good evidence to suggest, that school league tables have affected house prices. And of course, we would then expect that as house prices rise, some individuals may be incentivized to cash in on those rising house prices, while others in the rented sector may be pushed out of areas because they can no longer afford to stay in there as their contracts come up for renewal. But we also want to think about what exactly this kind of quantification is doing to the decision-making processes, because it's not as though people were making these decisions about school choice in a vacuum before the introduction of school league tables. Certainly, even today, as in the past, informal assessments of school quality were common. These sorts of informal social networks that provide information about how schools are doing, how good they are, still matter a great deal. In fact, some schools even publicize this type of information on their websites. Private schools in the UK, for example, talk about the number of their alumni that are able to get into elite universities. These aren't formal assessments necessarily, but they're more informal assessments of school quality. So when the school league tables come in and try to quantify school quality in particular kinds of ways, for Dan and I, as in many other instances, this kind of quantification of quality, actually creating these rankings, we argue reorganizes the status hierarchies in interesting ways and potentially even reconfigures standards and changes what we consider to be good in a meaningful way. And we think that this potentially plays out in two kinds of ways. First is specifically about the number itself. That is, it might be that these informal assessments lead you to think about the local schools in your area. But what this quantification and this ranking may do is it might reveal the fact that actually that good school in your area is only an average school when you situate it in the kind of national rankings. And that, I think, leads to the second important shift that this process of quantification engenders. And that is that it shifts the horizon of comparability. Now the schools can be compared not just to the few in your area, but you can now have information about all other schools, those many unknown schools that you've never heard about, and that you can now understand where the schools in your area are situated with respect to that ranking. And this matters because, as we know, parents are involved in a kind of national competition to some extent in trying to help their children get into the what they might consider to be the best universities. So the argument, very simply, is that the quantification of quality in this particular way may change how some parents looked at their local schools. And there is, of course, kind of mixed evidence, actually, when you look at whether these school choice reforms contributed to school segregation in particular. We actually can find evidence that points in a variety of different directions. And so there doesn't seem to be a kind of really strong consensus, it seems to us at least, about the effects that these reforms had. And actually, you can see similar results in the US. So we still think it's important to ask this question. Did the introduction of school league tables influence the degree of residential segregation over this period? And we think that there are a number of empirical implications that flow from the discussion that I've just tried to lay out for you. The first is that areas with high-performing schools will see an increase in the share of more advantaged individuals. For us, that's measured by the professional managerial share of a population. But we also think that after the reforms, after these league tables are published, that we would expect advantaged individuals to become more likely to move to areas with better performing schools according to this metric, and also then to move into areas with a greater share of professional and managerial occupations. We also think, third, that these changes in the link between social class and residential segregation will be concentrated among individuals who are parents of school age or even younger children. That's because we think these school league tables would have been particularly salient for that population. And our approach differs in a few ways from earlier work. First, we use aggregate census data to investigate the kind of association between school quality and changes in occupational class composition. And then we also use individual level panel data drawn from the Office for National Statistics longitudinal study, which enables us to track individuals over time, but also actually over a relatively long period of time, much longer than some of the other data sets available to us. So as I've mentioned, the data for our study comes from census data for England primarily from 1981 to 2011. Our aggregate level study uses data from 1991 forward, and the longitudinal study goes from 1981 forward. The longitudinal study, for those that may not have heard of it, is a 1% sample of the English and Welsh populations, and it links those census records to various kinds of life events, including residential mobility, which is what we exploit here. In terms of our measure of residential segregation, we're particularly interested in occupational class. We use the NSSEC to measure that, and we're primarily focused, as I've mentioned before, on professional managerial and routine and semi-routine occupations, partly because we believe that these represent relatively advantaged and disadvantaged groups within society. These intermediate classes, we sort of group them together. They're a little bit less, we focus on them a little bit less and focus on the top and the bottom. In terms of measuring school performance, we basically tried to recreate the information in school league tables that parents would have had and that they would have been responding to. And primarily, this is the percentage achieving A star to C grades at GCSEs, high stakes exams. These have a major influence on media and policy discussions, but there's also evidence that actually this simple measure of school performance affects house prices, unlike some of the more complex measures, the value added measures, which have been published in more recent years. We also would like to acknowledge that Steve Givens and Sandra McNally for sharing this data with us. We're really grateful to them for doing that. A word quickly on geography. Schools don't have kind of strictly defined district boundaries. And so we use the smallest administrative areas that are consistently available over time before and after the reform, and that's the local authority district. Now it has some advantages and some disadvantages. We also try to deal with boundary changes over time using kind of standard methods. So I'm gonna say a little bit more about these disadvantages and advantages to this approach, but also say a little bit about what our focus is. We're not really trying to understand why people move. Rather, we're interested on where they go when they leave an area. So in some ways, we're assuming people leave a local authority, maybe for work, for example, and that they have some choice over where they live. Now, we know that lots of residential mobility to get into good schools is actually happens within relatively small areas. And this is a disadvantage of our approach. Local authorities are too large probably to capture some of that variation. But at the same time, lots of the kind of informal assessments of school quality and school choice are happening through word of mouth within those local communities. And so when you leave an area, some of that influence is perhaps washed away or at least mitigated somewhat. And so one of the advantages is that by focusing on people that leave a local authority, we're also able to kind of wash out some of that informal assessment and focus more precisely, we think, on the impact of the league tables precisely. Now, just very briefly, why is our approach perhaps distinctive? Firstly, we have a much longer time frame. This really matters because we think that the impact of school league tables will occur over the medium term, partly because residential mobility is pretty rare. We aim to create control groups, which is We want to look at what happened, was happening to behavior before these league tables were introduced, and then also create some subgroups where we think the impact of these league tables would have been less salient, that is, individuals without children. And then some work has previously focused on the kind of free school meals, the composition of that and an area, but we think that most of the action will happen among the more advantaged groups. And so this type of indicator would actually kind of miss that. So we want to focus on occupational class as a way of capturing what's happening among those with more privilege. And then finally, as is really important always, is acknowledging the ONS for sharing their data with us, but also that we alone are responsible for the interpretation of our data. And on that, I'm going to hand over to Dan, who's going to talk through the results.
Right, okay, so I'm going to talk through the empirical side of this paper, starting first with the aggregate level analyses, where at an area level, we look at the association between school quality and changes in occupational class composition. So what we're interested in here is, after school league tables were introduced, what happened to the class compositions of places with better or worse schools? So this, and so school league tables were introduced in, I think, 1994. So we're looking at what happened after then, basically. This is a local authority year level analysis using data from 1991, 2001, and 2011. And our outcome variables are changes in the share of the population of the local authority employed in professional managerial occupations. And the second outcome variable is the share of the population involved in semi-routine or routine occupations. So these two occupation sets of occupations we think represent sort of the top and the bottom of the occupational class hierarchy. We also have a set of controls which are designed to adjust for other features of the social and economic context of areas that are likely to shape their class composition. So we've got, so to measure the ethnic immigrant composition, we've got the percent of the population born outside the UK. We also have a measure of job opportunities from the unemployment rate, a measure of the extent to which individuals can live in an area without paying market prices for housing, so the percentage of the population living in social housing, the percentage of the population employed in manufacturing industries, because that provides relatively well-paying jobs for low-skilled individuals, and also population density. And so this is our basic model specification. So it's an OLS regression with our outcome variable is change in class share between two census waves. So that could be the change in the professional managerial share from 1991 to 2001 or from 2001 to 2011. And our main explanatory variable is this measure of school performance that Aaron's talked about. So the percentage of students in a local authority that achieve 5 A star to C grades at GCSE, so at the end of lower secondary education. And this is averaged across time, so that in a case where our outcome variable is changes in class composition from 2001 to 2011, we're looking at average school performance over the 2001 to 2011 period. Obviously there's a problem with this model whereby obviously areas that have higher professional managerial shares and more advantaged populations, they're going to have higher quality schools. So to adjust for that, at least partially, we adjust for the starting class share in our areas at baseline. So for changes between 2001 and 2011, we adjust for class shares in 2001. We also control for changes in all of the area level covariates on the previous slide and time and region fixed effects. And this table has basic headline results from those analyses. So what we see is that in areas with high performing schools saw increases in professional managerial share, and that estimate is both with and without controls for area level covariates. The estimate's a bit larger when we control for area level covariates. The results point in the expected direction, but are a bit weaker for changes in the semi and routine share. So higher school performance is associated with decreases in the share of semi and semi-routine occupations. However, in the models without controls, the 95% confidence intervals cross zero. So we can't be so confident with that. So this is also kind of reinforces our expectation that the relation is consistent with our expectation that the relationship will be stronger for the top of the occupational hierarchy, for professional managerial occupations. Now, so this analysis kind of establishes some basic plausibility for our accounts. Areas with better performing schools see increases in professional managerial occupation, the share of the population employed in professional managerial occupations. However, we can test much more precisely some more specific empirical implications from our account using our individual level data. And in our individual level study, we're looking at how the association between social class and the school quality of the area that you live in changes over time among people who are residentially mobile. And this is to slightly reiterate what Aaron said already, but to kind of make it a bit more precise. We've basically got three expectations in this analysis. Our first expectation is that professional managerial parents will become more likely to move to areas with high performing schools after the introduction of league tables. So more, and by more likely we mean they get more likely relative to parents in semi-routine classes. So the class disparities will get wider. And then secondly, the kind of a corollary of that first implication is that if professional managerial parents become more likely to move to areas with better schools, then we'd also expect that as a result, they're moving to areas with greater professional managerial shares. So all else equal, if people in professional managerial occupations are moving to areas where they're already more concentrated, then all else equal, that should increase the geographical concentration of occupational class. And finally, we expect that these differences will be observed only among the parents, or at least they'll be a lot stronger among the parents of school-aged children. I mean, straightforwardly, school-aged children have a strong incentive. The parents of school-aged children have a strong incentive to ensure that their children are getting the best possible quality education. Of course, people who don't have school-aged children might also have an incentive to move into areas with good schools because they might benefit from house price increases, but the effect should be less strong than for the parents of school-aged children. So the data we're using, as Aaron's mentioned, is from the ONS longitudinal study from 1981 to 2011. So this is a 1% sample of the English population linked over successive censuses. Now, our focus is on individuals who move local authority between two time points. So for example, who move local authority between 2001 and 2011, so between T and T plus one. And we're restricting our sample to people who are aged between 20 and 50 at T, so in 2001, for example, because those are ages at which it's reasonable to expect that people could have school-aged children in the household. And we measure whether there are school-aged children in the household at either T or T plus one. Overall, our data contains about 500,000 observations on 300,000 individuals. And about 115,000 of these observations are moves between local authorities. It's quite a high number, and that's part of the power of the longitudinal studies. Both its very large sample size and the long time period means you get quite a lot of residential moves, which is and residential moves, especially over longer distances, are quite a rare event. Okay, so we've got two main outcome variables. So our first outcome variable is the average school quality of the areas of the local authorities that people live in at T plus one. And so this is measured using the league tables. However, we don't have a measure of school quality from before the league tables were created, were introduced in about 1994. The way we deal with this in practice is that we average school quality within areas over time, over the whole 1994 to 2011 period, and then kind of forecast this back to 1991 before school league tables were introduced. What this means is that our outcome variable in this analysis is kind of a counterfactual. It's basically enabling us to ask the question, given schools of kind of a similar quality, after the introduction of school league tables, do professional managerial parents become more likely to move into these kind of areas than they were before school league tables were introduced? Now, this strategy is justified by the fact that if you look at the overtime correlation in school performance within areas, it's very high. So suggesting that we're not losing too much by using this kind of counterfactual strategy. And our second outcome variable is the professional managerial share of the population in the area that someone lives in at T plus one. So this is allowing us to tie our analysis back to the outcome that we're finally interested in, which is the geographical distribution of occupational class advantage. So now to come on to our methods. So the basic logic of our approach is a kind of three-way interaction between time, so the census year, occupational class you're in, and whether there are school-aged children in the household. So we're letting occupational class differences in school quality differ over time and according to whether there are children in the household or not. However, this approach, there's a kind of a big obstacle we need to overcome in this approach, which is that there are big class differences in the probability of moving house, of moving area in the first place. So professional managerial people are much more likely to move area, which means that there's a kind of selection bias into the sample of people who move local authority. And the way we address that is by using a Heckman sample selection model. And that what that is a two-stage regression model. And in the first stage of the regression model is a probit regression, where the outcome is a binary variable indicating whether people have moved area or not. And this first stage is then estimates from this first stage are then used to adjust the second stage regression to ensure that selection bias basically doesn't bias our results. And the second stage of our model is an OLS regression model, where the main set of predictors of interest is this freeway interaction between occupational class, the presence of children, and time. Both the selection and the outcome models have this freeway interaction in them, as well as a bunch of controls for other features of individuals or the households they live in that are likely to be associated with their propensity to move areas and also the kinds of areas that they're likely to end up in when they do move. The selection equation also controls for all of the area level variables that we used in the aggregate level study to adjust for the fact that, for example, professional managerial people might be more likely to leave areas with bad local labour markets as measured by a high unemployment rate, for example. And then just to make this concrete, this is the basic equation. So the outcome variable is, one of our outcome variables, which is the one displayed here, is school quality in the area that someone who moves area ends up in at T plus one. And there's the freeway interaction effect between occupational class, time, and the presence of children, the set of individual level covariates, and the lambda represents the selection hazard estimated from the first stage, which basically adjusts our results for the fact that there's selection into residential mobility according along the lines of social class. Okay, so freeway interaction effect is actually kind of a pain to actually interpret in practice. So we're not going to directly interpret those. What we're going to do is once we run these models, we predict for each combination of occupational class, time, and the presence of children, the estimated mean of our outcome variable. So the estimated school performance at T plus one. And then what we do is we use these estimated marginal means to look at what we're actually interested in. And that's illustrated in equation three. So in equation three, what we're looking at is, firstly, we're looking at class differences in 2011 in the school quality of the area you live in. And then we're subtracting that from that, the class difference in outcome in school quality in 1991 or 1980, so before school league tables were introduced. So what we're basically asking is, has the difference in school quality grown, the class difference in school quality grown after the introduction of school league tables? So there's a kind of difference in differences, if you like. And so here's the first of our, the results for our first outcome variable, for school performance at T plus one. What we can see here is that the class differences in school quality at T plus one increased after the introduction of school league tables So the gap in school quality between parents of school-aged children in professional occupations increased, or the gap between professional parents in professional occupations and those in semi-routine occupations increased after the introduction of school league tables. And what we can also see is that this association is only visible among the parents of school-aged children. There's no change in school quality, in the class gap in school quality for those who aren't parents of school-aged children. So this is consistent with two of our empirical implications. Though it's worth pointing out that the effect size is pretty small. It's like a 1 percentage point change. But nonetheless, it's consistent with our expectations. And then this plot here shows our second outcome variable, so professional managerial share at T plus one. So what we see here is similar to the first plot. Class differences increase after the introduction of school league tables. So professional managerial parents become relatively more likely, or end up living in areas with higher professional managerial shares relative to those in semi-routine occupations after the introduction of school league tables. In this case, we see that there's some evidence that a similar process was also happening for those who aren't parents of school-aged children, but the coefficient estimates are larger for those with school-aged children. So again, providing some evidence for our third empirical implication. Okay, so I'm going to have to kind of try and wrap up and draw on back to some of the broader theoretical issues now. But first, to kind of sum up our results. So we're trying to make the case in this paper that the publication of school league tables in the early 90s in England increased the geographical concentration of occupational class advantage. And we're basing that on kind of two main pieces of evidence. First, that after the introduction of school league tables, areas with higher performing schools saw increases in the professional managerial population. The results are less strong for semi-routine and routine occupations. And the second piece of evidence is that after the introduction of school league tables, parents in more advantaged social classes became more likely to move to areas with high performing schools and also to areas with more advantaged populations. And as a result, all else equal, what this suggests is that the introduction of school league tables is leading professional managerial parents to be more likely to move to areas that have large professional managerial populations, therefore increasing the geographical concentration of occupational class. However, it's one thing that's important to take into account when interpreting our results is that there are two ways in which inequalities between areas, whether that's neighborhoods, local authorities, or broader regions, can arise. One of those is through this kind of process of geographical sorting that we've described, where advantaged people differentially move to advantaged areas. The other, though, is that if areas with more advantaged populations see higher growth rates, then that will also increase the inequalities between regions. And it's important to bear in mind that at least in the US, for quite large regions, differential growth rates are a much bigger explanation of increasing regional inequalities than sorting processes. So it's important to bear that in mind when interpreting these results. However, we do think that our results speak to this broader literature on the causes and consequences of residential segregation. And one way in which our results speak to that literature is we also find, like for example, Reardon and Bischoff's work on inequality and income segregation, we find more evidence that the behavior of people at the top of the hierarchy, in this case, the occupational class hierarchy, are important than we do the decisions or behavior of people at the bottom of the occupational class hierarchy, as evidenced by our finding that areas with higher performing schools see increases in professional managerial occupations, but less strong evidence that they see decreases in routine and semi-routine occupations. Another contribution of our paper is to this idea that while neighbourhoods are important, while neighbourhood effects are important because the area you live in is an important venue for the kinds of social norms and kind of information you were exposed to, but institutions can actually play a really important role in structuring who ends up in which area, and therefore kind of setting the stage on which neighborhood effects can then operate. And we try to make the case that quantification is a particularly important, plays a particularly important role in, and when institutions institute processes of quantification, it plays a particularly important role in determining the sorting of people into certain kinds of areas. And quantification does this because it's not a kind of neutral process. Quantification, as I think Espeland and Sorter put it, can recreate social worlds. So in this case, school ranks, school league tables, by taking a bunch of very diverse and individual local schools, you know, with a wide variety of different characteristics, and ranking them on a single unidimensional measure of performance, can change how people look at them, those schools. And it can do so by bringing them into competition with one another, because they can now all be compared on a single unidimensional ranking. And also by changing the geographical horizon over which people can compare schools. So after the introduction of school league tables, no longer can you only really form an impression of schools that you might know people who attend, parents whose children attend, but you can find out how your local school compares to any school in the country. So quantification plays an important role in changing how institutions can sort people into different areas or neighborhoods. And as many scholars of quantification have kind of come to realize in recent years, quantification can play an important role in the reproduction of inequalities in society. And it does so basically because different people will be, with different amounts of resources, will be differentially able to respond to the information contained in things like school league table rankings. So quite straightforwardly, once this new information about school quality is revealed to the world, it's going to be, some parents are going to be more able than others to use the information contained within them. And especially some parents are going to have greater ability to move to areas with high performing schools based on their wealth, and their access to, and their ability to afford housing in the areas with the best schools. So so to kind of sum up our argument, just kind of tie everything together, it might be the case that quantifying school performance allows parents to make more informed decisions. And then this indeed was the rationale for releasing things like, creating things like school league tables in the first place. But in doing so, we've tried to present the case for thinking that these school league tables have led to an increased geographical concentration of occupational class advantage, basically by inducing occupational professional managerial parents to move to areas with good schools, which are also areas with that have existing high professional managerial populations. Thank you.
Thank you so much for this fantastic talk. I will have a look, it's not that easy right now, to see whether there's someone raising his or her hand. Alpa.
Thank you so much for this absolutely fascinating presentation. I learned a lot from it, and I was very interested in this whole idea of quantifying reproducing inequality, which I'm sure there's many other people in this room are much greater experts than I, but I'd like to ask you two questions about your paper. One is whether you could give us examples of where you see the broader theoretical relevance and practical relevance of the implications being played out internationally in that, you know, quantification reproduces or quantification exacerbates inequality. I'd love to know of other examples where you see this process happening around the world. The second question was much more a British focused question, which is the introduction of free schools in England, whether you see this as reversing this process in any way, because, you know, when parents have the ability to create schools in their own localities, whether you see, you know, the movement into areas which have better schools being countered in any way by parents actually creating better schools in their own neighborhoods. So yeah, I just wondered whether the impact of free schools had any implications on your broader conclusions.
Those are great questions, thank you. In terms of the broader relevance, there's at least one study from the US that suggests a very similar thing is happening when there's a nonprofit in the US called the Great Schools Initiative, I think. And there's a paper that uses the kind of staggered geographical rollout of that to suggest that in places where Great Schools was operational, you saw increases in income and racial segregation. That said, I think also there's also a much broader theoretical question here about how quantification might be involved in reproducing inequalities. And, you know, the kind of theoretical work on this has spanned quite a wide range of areas, from everything from kind of credit scores to university and college rankings. I think there's loads of room to take this kind of idea further. I mean, China's social credit system might be another good example. In terms of data on free schools, so our data stops in 2011, which is about the time that free schools were first being introduced. So we can't speak directly to that. I don't really see why free schools should change that story. Then the reason for that is that, firstly, these schools are still going to be ranked in the same kind of performance tables. Secondly, in the US, I think breaking the strict link between you live in this school district, so you go to that school, was seen by some people as being very important for breaking the link between the neighborhood you live in and the school you attend. However, in the UK, that link was never quite as strict in the first place, partly because we've got a more complicated and institutionally variegated education system. So we used to have grammar schools, for example, and we still have like church schools, which allow for a certain amount of soft selection. I don't think free schools would change that a great deal. Aaron, have you got anything to add to that?
Maybe just very briefly, which is the great, great questions. Thank you. The free school thing I think is really important. My assumption is that some of the creation of these schools still takes quite a lot of resources, both local, financial, and so in some ways you would expect that the creation of high quality free schools is potentially still underpinned by many of the same resource constraints that might be associated with access to high performing public state schools. So I think there's perhaps another reason why that barrier would exist. In terms of the kind of first point about broader theoretical relevance, yeah, I think it runs across the gamut, from issues of states measuring the quality of their citizens through like their adherence to kind of social norms we see in some contexts, right through to credit, health systems are measured in very similar kinds of ways. And so I think there's a wide variety of settings in which this plays out, and potentially lots of scope for the reproduction of advantage in those contexts. So, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. I have Amelia Peterson next, and then Chico. And after that, we have lots of questions also in the chat.
Hi, thank you for this. This was awesome. Also, really beautiful slide design. That was great. So, I mean, this feels like a really compelling kind of story, this idea that, like, you introduced league tables and sort of it has this implications. As you said, we saw this a bit with great schools, but I just want to have a couple of questions about sort of the focus on league tables specifically, because obviously in England as well, we had Ofsted coming in around the same kind of time, and that idea of school reports, which then a little bit later on were that kind of very simple, like good outstanding indicator. Sort of how do you think about the difference between like national rankings versus those kind of classifications? And then also, how do you think about the general towards greater competitiveness in education, and so parents just being more, you know, caring more about school quality perhaps over the period you're looking at. So how do we think about kind of league tables as the driver versus those perhaps, you know, wider changes and sort of how parents were viewing the importance of quality education?
Yeah, let me try briefly. Thank you. Great questions. Really, both are really important. So I should actually have said it right at the beginning that this paper is still a work in progress. So all of this is incredibly helpful to us. So thank you so much. So on the Ofsted point, yeah, actually, I think that there's people that are doing a little bit of work on Ofsted at the moment. Fabian Accomunati is doing some work on this, I know, at the moment. So that's perhaps a separate kind of issue. I think that Ofsted clearly matters, but I think it matters in interesting kinds of ways. So Ofsted, at least my understanding of the process, is that school performance is an important contributor to the Ofsted rankings. And what matters here then is that, my understanding is that it's very difficult for a school to get outstanding on Ofsted if it hasn't got outstanding results. So it sort of needs that to some extent as a condition of its being able to get a very good Ofsted ranking. Now, I'm sure there are some exceptions to that, but I think it's generally true that it's very hard to pass apart. So in some ways we would expect Ofsted and our school rankings to be, school league tables to be somewhat highly correlated, and the Ofsted reports are capturing some of the more school specific aspects, and some of that changes over time. So at the moment, a heavy emphasis in Ofsted is on safeguarding rules within the schools, which may or may not be a really crucial dimension in sort of thinking about the school choices that people make, though it is certainly important for the state itself. In terms of that broader competitiveness, I think this is a really crucial thing that Dan and I have thought about a little bit. He may want to say more about both of these in a second, but I think our response would be that part of what's happening through this period is actually a really large increase in the number of university places that is happening. And so in some ways, while it might be true that parents became more concerned about helping their children get into universities, that's happening at the same time that the pressure on them to get their kids into is diminishing because access is increasing. There are many more places for their children to get into. So we see these as sort of offsetting processes if it is indeed true that there's more competition among parents, which I think is hard for us to reconstruct going back now, at least. So if anyone had data on that, I'd be really fascinated to know. So I think we think both of these are really important, though none of them, at least in our view, really offsets the main part of the story that we're telling here.
Okay, I have Chico Ferreira next.
All right, thanks. Thanks for that presentation, very nice. Really interesting question as well. So now that Alpa and Amelia have asked the interesting questions, let me ask a boring question of identification, just to make sure I understand what you actually did. So as you noted, this is a question riven with endogeneity, right? Because the possibility of endogeneity bias, because of course, the movement of higher occupation people into these areas may itself be causing the improvement in school quality. So you mentioned these three-way interactions, and you also mentioned the difference in difference thing at some point. So I'm trying to get my head around what your actual identification strategy was, and I think it was probably a triple difference, right? So you have a difference between high occupation and low occupation people moving. So high occupation and low occupation people moving into these areas. Then there's a difference between those with children and those without children. And the third difference is between before and after the introduction of the league tables. So it's that triple thing there. So I wanted to understand whether that is right, and you're nodding your head, that's great. And so then the question is, with a triple difference, much as with a double difference, the identification assumption is that the pre-existing trends on the double difference would have, you know, were parallel. So it's a parallel trends assumption, which I think in this case would mean that the difference between families with children and families without children moving into these areas was was parallel before the introduction of the reform. So there was something about the families with and without children that were not diverging already before the thing is introduced. You know, that their movements in and out of these areas was parallel before the introduction of this thing, right? That would give you some identification, particularly given that families with and without children differ in lots of other ways, income, age, and so on and so forth. So if I got your identification strategy right, can you comment on whether you actually tested for this parallel trends assumption?
Okay, thank you. That's really helpful. I think we've still not worked out how best to communicate exactly how that analysis works, I think. So I think thank you just for helping unpack it. So I'm not sure. I think, yeah, you're of course, an assumption of our analysis is about parallel trends pre-reform in class disparities. I need to think a little bit more about this point about that differences between parents and non-parents also have to be parallel before pre-reform. We haven't explicitly tested for that assumption holds, and I guess that's that either of those assumptions hold. And I guess that is a good thing to do. I think, yeah, you're completely right that there are lots of other ways that the composition of the non-parent versus parent households might change over time. And I think, I know that from some other kind of analysis we've done around this, that certainly trends in overall occupational class segregation are very stable over that. Or at least a parallel over that period. But I think, yeah, we do need to probably do some more work checking the underlying assumption about parallel trends in class differences in residential mobility behavior. So yeah, thank you for pushing us on that.
Maybe if I just quickly respond, we do, our results do show parallel trends across classes within parents who have children and parents and people without children. But what we haven't done, I think, is tested the difference between parents with parents and non-parents. And that's perhaps where we need to just check to see if that one is also parallel. The other broader thing is to say that our results here go against the wider trend that's happening within the population, at least according to some analyses. So there's a kind of decrease in the degree of occupational segregation in general, and so our analysis is sort of working against that as well, which I think is also, it's not that we're seeing a kind of acceleration of a already existing trend. If anything, this is like working against what we might have seen in the population more broadly, which I think again reinforces that more general point about that we sort of think this is a sort of plausible move. But we can definitely check that difference between parents and non-parents in terms of making sure that they're parallel too. But it's a great question, thank you.
Okay, I will now read out several questions from the chat, and I would ask you to reply quickly to them. The first one is by Kirsten Zehnbruch. Thank you so much. Does Ofsted still publish value-added indicators in the rankings? And if so, are they useful in this context? Then we have a question by Isabel de Brigard. Thank you so much. I was wondering if you know or found any difference across class sections with regards to the willingness to put their children through longer commutes to school, which might impact your results regarding how families move within neighborhoods. And then a question by Stella Escandel. Are you planning to extend your research to other cases such as Chile? There are more questions, but let's try to answer these first.
I think I can't remember what the current state of school league tables is with regard to value added indicators. However, they've been sporadically in league tables over the period that we study. The existing research that we're aware of suggests that at least in the US, value added indicators don't have much impact on parental behavior, while raw scores do. So I think we're taking the view that value-added indicators, while they're better from a kind of perspective of genuinely representing school performance, aren't always as powerful at influencing behavior. The question about commuting is a very good one. Yeah, we don't have data on the schools that children are actually attending, so we don't know about their commuting patterns. But that does seem like quite a reasonable assumption in cases where school attendance isn't strictly defined by neighborhood and where there are large house price inequalities. I guess one issue is that in cases where schools are very oversubscribed and they can select on like academic performance, they're going to be selecting higher income children from higher income backgrounds more in the first place, because children of advantaged parents tend to do better in these selection tests. And to Stella's point, so the project I work on now, it's called SchoolPoll, it's an ERC funded project at Oxford, with doing a vast amount of data collection on education and the role it plays in society across loads of countries. And I'm actually really interested in hearing any suggestions of data, countries that have data quality, data that might allow us to answer these kind of questions. So yeah, I'd love to extend this kind of analysis to other contexts. It's quite demanding data wise. But yeah, I'd love to.
Maybe just say two very brief things. One is that the commuting point is really important, and I think if anything probably would suppress the effect that we see in our analysis, because it's intuitive to expect that more affluent households are willing to get their kids to commute further and therefore don't need to move, and so then this would potentially push down the effect that we see. The thing about Chile is I actually have a DPhil student who is finishing her PhD at the moment and has been studying the educational reforms in Chile and their effect on occupational attainment. I don't know if anyone's done something. I'm not aware of someone that's done something on residential mobility within that context, but presumably that would be possible. I think that would be possible with some of the data that she has been using. So it's maybe an open and exciting research project that someone could explore.
And we have one that was related to the previous question, whether by Parth Oshomi, a senior visiting researcher, perhaps the solution among many could be busing of students from one local area to another. That would alleviate at least some of the challenges you concluded on. That would be one point. And then by Paul McCann, in your research, are you assuming that high performance schools are necessarily the best? Where does value added fit into your conclusions? Maybe you can say something to that. And then by Marnie Caton, do you need to consider the effect of selection? Grammar schools are still a large pool for parents in some large local areas, for example, Kent. And I think after that, we need to finish.
Sure. Well, let me say something quickly to a couple of those. Yeah, the policy implications, I would be against busing, because I think what we need to do is situate these results in the wider context of the neighborhood effects literature. So it's not just the kind of school effect that really matters here. What we think, when we think about neighborhood effects more broadly, it's a configuration of things that are playing out in affecting life chances. And so in some ways, this is mitigating perhaps one dimension of that without addressing many of the other features. And so I'd be skeptical about that being making a long-term significant difference to outcomes. No, I don't think we do make an assumption that these schools are necessarily better. What we're trying to do is think about how the process by which the state renders these schools as better, by virtue of the quantification process, is altering decision making. And we think that that probably has consequences, if not through the school directly, then certainly through the concentration of advantage in geographical areas. And so I don't think we want to make a strong claim about the kind of objective veracity of the rankings. Rather, we're thinking about the kind of social processes implied in what those rankings are doing. And I'll maybe let Dan say something about grammar schools, because I know he's been thinking about that, if that's okay.
So just to reiterate what Aaron said, or to Paul's point, I personally don't think the measure in school league tables are particularly useful, and they've been criticised for a wide variety of reasons. That's kind of not the point. I think we care about what other people take seriously as measures of school quality, basically. And then on the grammar schools point, it's highly possible that parents might differentially move to areas with grammar school, sort of professional managerial parents might differentially move to areas with grammar schools. This is unlikely to be changing the overall story we're telling for two reasons. One, the number of grammar schools is pretty small, remaining grammar schools. And secondly, the process of comprehensivization had basically finished by the time our study starts, or at least, and certainly by the time that school league tables were introduced. So it was mostly done by the early 80s, the conversion of grammar and secondary modern schools into comprehensives. But it's something worth investigating in more detail, the effect, how this kind of story changes in context, say in a country like Germany, where you still have a highly selective school system, whether that, the extent to which that changes the kind of story that we're talking about here.
Okay, thank you all so much. Thank you for a fantastic talk, and thank you to the audience for a very engaged discussion. We hope to see you for one of the upcoming events of the III, maybe tomorrow for the Politics of Inequality, and have a lovely day, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. And thank you, Nora, for hosting.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much.